Inside the Cross Podcast.
Thanks for downloading the Inside the Cross D1 Podcast. I'm your host, Dan Flynn, joined as always by my man, Terry Foy. If you like what you hear, please tell a friend. Subscribe to us on iTunes. You can leave a rating and a comment there. And you can hit us up on Twitter at @D_Fly for me and at Terrence Foy. If you'd like to share a thought, a comment, or a question, email us at dflynn@insidelacrosse.com or tfoy@insidelacrosse.com. As the season is wound down, we won't be as frequent with our podcast, but we hope you'll still check us out from time to time, and I hope you checked out the Sounds of the Final Four, a podcast featuring Zach Babbo, Matt Kinnear, and Dan Ahern as they listened and reacted to comments coming away from championship weekend. It's a good one, so be sure to check that out if you haven't. On today's show, we'll be discussing the coaching carousel, Terry. We'll look at the Tewaratin ceremony and awards. We'll go over the All-America teams, some of the snubs, some of the ones that coaches got right. And we'll take a look at Christian Sweezy's way ahead rankings for 2017. Let's go. Terry, let's talk about some of the coaching moves or lack of movement.
Yeah, we are about 3 weeks removed from Dom Starja no longer being the head coach of the University of Virginia, and we have two openings down of the seven. Hartford has promoted Ryan Martin. Excuse me.
Yep.
And just last Friday, John Galloway was named the third head coach in the history of the Jacksonville Dolphins men's
love that
program.
Love that hire.
Yeah. So John, obviously 2011 alum from Syracuse, began his collegiate coaching career as a volunteer assistant at Duke and has been a assistant under Chris Gabrielli at Providence since. He plays professionally for the Rochester Rattlers, was involved with the U.S. national team in 2014, and is a prodigy, really, a whiz. But the thing that's most exciting about this addition to Jacksonville, and certainly the influence of the Syracuse program there down in Northeast Florida, is that it's not just John Galloway.
Yeah, he's got a big name assistant coach who joined his staff, too.
An ace up his sleeve, as it were.
Yeah, Casey Powell is going to be his offensive coordinator.
You ever heard of him?
Isn't that Ryan's brother? But he's going to be his offensive coordinator and has been in Florida for a while.
Yeah, he's got the lay of the land down pat.
He does, and that is significantly changed the profile of that school for high school players who are potential recruits.
Both in the Southeast as well as, dialed into Central New York and kind of every part in between. I think that it's interesting. Casey, with his speed lacrosse crew, came by the Inside Lacrosse offices in April, had indicated to me that he was interested in getting into college coaching, and I said, that seems like a great fit. Really excited to see how it shakes out for you. And then in a Nissan chat on the Thursday before the Final Four, stated publicly that intention, both that he planned to retire as a player at the end of this MLL season and get into college coaching. And it did not take long for that to come to fruition. And obviously, to be, kind of tandem, both in terms of their connections to the Syracuse program, their impressive playing resumes, their familiarity with each other. It seems like a really good partnership in the making, and I'm curious to see how they round out their staff with a third selection at some point in the future as well.
I figured that Jacksonville would hire a current Division I assistant, possibly a Division III head coach might go there, but I really think they hit a home run with this. I remember a few years ago, Terry, when Duke, I think, was playing in the Faceoff Classic or one of our stadium events. And the Duke, Art Chase, the sports information guy at Duke, and another guy, maybe a athletic trainer or an equipment guy, came in with Art and was talking. And he said, this is when John was the volunteer assistant. He said, we have the next coaching star on our staff. And we're like, who are you talking about? Like, Ron Caputo? Like, he's like, no, this guy volunteer, John Galloway, Syracuse kid. He's amazing. The kids love him. He's very knowledgeable, and he's got the right personality and fit for this, and the charisma, I guess, to be a head coach, and he's a rising star. And I've been sort of following it since then. We paid him a visit at Providence a couple years ago. We went and watched their sort of fall ball night game before doing our showcase at, down the street at Brown. And you could see it then and there. He gave us a tour of their new facility. He's great.
Yeah.
And I'm really happy for him and the Jacksonville program.
It's not a surprise that he was able to land this opportunity based on the first impression that he makes with most folks that he comes across. And I think that, you know, that speaks to their increased potential in recruiting as a result. But, you know, my kind of firsthand account of John is, it, you know, to your point, the enthusiasm, the positivity that he brings is immediate, but it doesn't end there. Similarly, probably in almost exact same span of time as when you met him, I was at our Southeast Invitational in Atlanta, and he was there. I was sitting next to him and Will Manny, and one of the coaches for one of the teams had to duck out before their last game, and John stepped in as the head coach of the team. You know, just met the kids, learned their names almost immediately, and 5 minutes in was able to identify and try to help correct half the team's problems in terms of individual players' flaws in their game. And there's nothing more rudimentary, there's nothing more elemental about coaching than that. And I certainly think he's going to be a good ambassador and representative for that program.
So you mentioned that Ryan Martin was promoted to the Hartford head coach. UMBC, Vermont, and Binghamton also remain open. But let's talk about
Let's not bury the lead.
So Virginia, there was some... How do you describe
movement?
Some drama,
yeah.
Some storylines sort of emerged that Kevin Corrigan, the Notre Dame head coach, was going to return to his alma mater, where he also was a assistant coach, started his career there under Ace Adams.
Yep.
And we had heard some rumors that it was sort of a done deal, and it was just, when will they make an announcement?
Well, and there were some who... stated as fact on different online channels that it had occurred. Widespread speculation, you know, certainly almost to the point of conventional wisdom. This was just kind of the belief of the course of action that was going to be taken. There was so much about it that was logical. You know, it's funny because, and this is, it's hard to have this conversation without reverting to a conversation that we had two podcasts ago, which is just how you handle these breaking news situations,
yeah.
How you handle the reportage. And, you know, in the way that there were folks who questioned our judgment as it related to Dom Stargis' fluctuating situation and his status at Virginia, the decision-making process was really kind of detached from the content of the story. It had much more to do with who the people were that were telling us. These were folks that had firsthand knowledge of what was going on. You know, as it related to Kevin's involvement with the Virginia Athletic Department and whatever conversations may or may not have occurred, I didn't have any firsthand knowledge of this. I mean, the conversations from my perspective were very tight-lipped. You know, I feel like over the course of the process, I had two kind of firsthand contacts and one secondhand contact that were very reliable. None of them was able to confirm to me that Kevin Corrigan actually interviewed for this job. So we didn't report that. And we didn't report that he was offered the position, that he was considering it, that he had taken it back to Notre Dame, or any of these things that have been speculated as having occurred. He circulated an email that I believe was sent to alums last Thursday evening that was forwarded on to us by multiple folks, and that in and of itself was newsworthy because he said there that he was essentially going to be the Notre Dame head lacrosse coach going forward. And given the context of that email being sent, you know, it obviously meant something. It was significant. It was newsworthy. And so we posted it. And I think that it provided a little bit of finality to the speculation. And now on we go. That was 4 days ago. And to be honest with you, I have not been told by somebody who has firsthand knowledge of the situation, a single coaching candidate who has been contacted or spoken to a member of the Virginia Athletic Department since Thursday evening. You know, there's been a few interesting things that have developed in the interim, starting with the announcement from the Yale Athletic Department that Andy Shea had extended his deal. I think that there's strong reason to believe that Andy was in the mix at Virginia. I don't know to what degree he was in the mix. My impression is that it didn't rise to the level of being offered the opportunity at Virginia. I think that it was preemptive on Yale's part to lock him up, to increase whatever buyout an incoming party would have to take on in order to be able to employ him. So here we are. I think that, you know, there's a pool of guys that...
Who's in this pool of candidates, well, do you think?
Yeah, I mean, so it's like a little bit uncomfortable, right? Because, you know, there are some who I've been told and I feel very confidently are in. There are others who I'm more or less guessing. So I'm just going to throw all the names out there because then you're not going to be able to know who's who and I'm going to have a little bit of deniability. I think Denver assistant Matt Brown. I think Navy head coach Rick Soule. I would not be surprised if Richmond head coach Dan Shamati. And possibly Penn head coach Mike Murphy. Even within just saying that, there were degrees of qualification that you can kind of read between the lines with.
How long has Shamati been at Richmond?
Well, since the program was announced. So, you know, he got the job in the fall of 2012.
He left after they won the title? Like,
correct.
That season?
Correct. Yeah, but they didn't play as a team.
So he's the youngest. I don't know how old Matt Brown is, but, you know, the least experienced of the head coaches that are on this.
Shortest tenured.
Yeah,
yes.
Exactly. Least experienced is probably not the right way to describe it, but shortest tenured of the head coaches that are on this list.
Now, there's a couple of things I want to say about this. We as lacrosse people always look at this through the lacrosse lens. How could we do it any other way? Virginia sports fans look at it through the lens of Virginia athletics. So this is an athletic department that is hiring a softball coach, trying to retain its baseball coach, just hired a football coach, did a nice job hiring its basketball coach and then retaining him. So, you know, there's a lot about the personnel management that they've done that has shown itself not only to be very successful, but I think in a lot of these instances, very quiet. If I'm the athletic director of Virginia trying to make these decisions, I'm looking at this in the context of, you know, I've got all these other things on my plate. You know, I've had this experience. I've had that conversation. You know, I've got to get this done, whatever. So, you know, one of the conversations that I've had with a couple of folks in our office is that oftentimes there's urgency applied to these situations that is undue. And by that, I mean, and sometimes the processes themselves are very heavily criticized. So, you know, we saw this with Penn State after they had to replace Glenn Thiel, and midway through the process, it was being criticized as having been drawn out too long. And, you know, they were going to end up with a lesser candidate. Same thing happened at Maryland. The same thing happened with Navy. And I think that with Jeff Tamburoni, John Tillman, and Rick Soule, all three of the coaches that were brought in exceeded the expectations of the fan base at the point at which they were hired. So my argument is that the longer these things go on doesn't necessarily mean the less qualified candidate you're going to end up with. Nor does it mean that the process actually wasn't handled very smoothly. I think that there's an argument to be made that smooth processes oftentimes don't necessarily yield the best candidates because the diligence that has the time and thought that has gone into it, you know, hasn't been as robust. So, and the other thing too is that as these searches go on, the job itself changes. The amount of years on your contract, the amount of dollars on your contract, the amount of dollars that your assistant coaches can get paid, all these things that are negotiable, as the athletic department becomes a little bit more incentivized to bring somebody in and close this deal, they begin to bend a little bit more. It's like being a home buyer and looking at a house that's been on the market for 60 days. Well, it's been on the market for 60 days for a reason. So you're probably going to get a yes to an offer that wouldn't have gotten a yes after the house had been on the market for 15 days. So my point is that these things are very variable. I wouldn't be surprised if the eventual Virginia head coach was not one of the four guys that I just named. But if it is any of those four guys, I certainly believe that, you know, in contrast to, you know, be it Kevin Corrigan or Andy Shea, they could absolutely be the right guy for the job and do a very good job.
Yeah, one name that I've heard rumored to be in the mix is Lars Tiffany, who's a guy you didn't mention. Do you know anything about him being involved, or Dom was his coach at Brown, and he's sort of following him, and they're, you know, he's based on their season and the style that they played, very hot right now.
Yeah, I don't think he is in the mix.
Okay.
I don't have anything else to add.
Name him.
No. I mean, it's actually, it is surprising, I think, to some, that he wouldn't be, because it seems logical. But again,
it's tough to leave your alma mater, though, and that he's a Brown guy.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting, and fielding that question is uniquely awkward for me, because I was part of the process by which we reported that Penn State had offered Lars. In the, I believe, summer of 2010, I wrote that story. And over the course of the next 36 hours, the onslaught of support that he received from folks who wanted him to stay at Brown ended up really impacting his judgment, and he turned down the job. I think that 5 years later, 6 years later, given, all of the tumult that Jeff Tamburoni has had to navigate at Penn State, as well as all of the success that Lars has experienced at Brown, I'm sure that in retrospect, he looks at it like a good decision. But I think that in the moment, he regretted going on the record to talk about it, because it's not a decision that you necessarily want to have to make in the public eye. It's a decision that you want to make quietly, privately, and then once it's done, inform folks of.
So the other major coaching job is Princeton.
Yep.
And it's been pretty quiet from there, too. But we've had another possible candidate who is staying at his school with a public announcement.
This is something that I've never seen before in the sport of lacrosse, and if I followed other sports more closely, I might feel more confident in saying I've never seen it in any sport, which is a university announcing publicly that it is in conversation about an extension with its current head coach, and that is Marquette and Joe Amplo. Now, there's one significant extenuating circumstance, which is that the team is about to depart on an international trip to Italy, which I would imagine is a monumental moment for the program.
Sure.
Obviously, they attained levels of success, heights that could have previously been unimaginable, in beating Denver for the Big East Championship, hosting an NCAA tournament game, and then falling, I believe, by a goal to the eventual national champions.
Sure.
Then to be able to turn around and take that whole group of guys. I mean, typically that just means that's it. Like that Saturday or Sunday when you clean out your lockers is the last opportunity to be together as a team. Nope, not with this group. I believe that they just finished their fourth season, right? So this is their first graduating class, who many of whom had been on campus for 5 years. And they're like, you know what? No, we're going to extend this ride. 3 weeks after, 4 weeks after our season's over, we're going to go to Italy together. Oh my goodness. Can you imagine how much fun they're going to have over the next 10 days? So I feel like, in order to maximize the level of engagement and enjoyment, just like, hey, let's take some of the cloud out of this, some of the haziness out of this situation, as speculation begins to spread that you're in the mix for the Princeton job, and we're going to tell everybody that we're doing the best we can to retain you at Marquette.
Now, it's common. I mean, Andy Shea more or less just did this at Yale.
But this is the thing. They announced that a deal had been reached, not that a deal was ongoing.
Yeah,
because typically, when a deal is ongoing, if you acknowledge that, you're giving up a tremendous amount of leverage. Now, in this instance, I can understand why Marquette would think that we're actually gaining leverage by showing that we're increasing our commitment. We just haven't actually done it yet. We haven't finished yet. Mm-hmm. But you're also kind of incentivizing whoever might be in the mix for your candidate, for your target, for your guy. You're incentivizing them to work faster to get done before you get your deal inked. I don't know. It's just, it was really surprising when I read it, and it was great. I mean, I love the candor, and I love the transparency, and I love the seriousness with which the situation has developed. But like I said, it was just very surprising.
And meanwhile, Towson Athletic Director Tim Leonard has confirmed that Sean Nadelin had been contacted about the open Princeton job. And Leonard is confident he can keep Nadelin at Towson, and the school is working to keep him there.
Yeah, it's interesting because you mentioned earlier that UMBC remains open. Ed Lee posted a story probably about 10 days ago now, No, it was more recent than that. It would have been the beginning,
I think it was the beginning of last week.
In which Dave Petromala had a similar comment about
Bobby Benson.
About Bobby Benson, who had been approached by UMBC, but he was confident that he was going to stay at Johns Hopkins.
That was awkwardly worded too.
Yeah.
It was. It was just reading it back, like the actual statement that was in the Sun.
Yeah.
It just was funny the way Petro had stated it.
Yeah. And what's interesting about that too is, you know, the candidate pool that Ed listed was what I understood mm-hmm. it to be, with one exception. And my understanding is that it came down to Ryan Moran, who was listed in that candidate pool, and one other guy who I am told but have not confirmed, so I'm not reporting, nor will I say his name on this podcast, was offered the job. He's a head coach. He turned around and took it back to his boss and received a counteroffer, and is still deciding as to whether or not he's going to accept the UMBC job or stay at his current location.
That's interesting. And there were some other candidates that Ed listed.
Mm-hmm.
Kevin Conroy,
yeah, from Maryland.
Conroy.
Yeah.
And one other one that was his assistant coach.
Graham Neamy from Yale?
Yeah, that's who it was, I think. So the wheels keeps turning. This is common in other sports that, you know, you see this in football and basketball at the college level, where guys go back and they're sort of in the mix and then they say, no, I'm going to stay here, and they sign a contract extension. But I don't remember seeing it in lacrosse to this measure.
I agree.
In this many cases of it.
I agree, and I wonder, there are two possible reasons why this feels new. The first is because it's happening for the first time in mass, and it's happening because they're emulating their football and basketball peers. And the second is because it's happened before, we just didn't know about it. And now, whether it's because of the reportage or because of the, and it hasn't been because of Inside Lacrosse's reportage, but because of the university's own desire to have this be known, or the candidate's desire to have this be known. You know what's interesting about it is that, like, we didn't know what Andy Shea's contract was like before that extension came out. Now we do, to a degree. And so now, in the same way that a big part of the attention paid to Dom Starge's job status heading into the 2016 season was a product of the 2012 announcement that he had received a 5-year deal that was going to end at the end of the, well, ran through January, but it was not going to include the 2017 season, you know, being able to implement those or apply those types of stories to other jobs just makes the awareness of what possible speculation, what possible situations are. You know, one of the things that's really interesting about how coaches weigh these factors is security, right? And so, you know, if you're, a lot of these deals tend to be 3 to 5 year deals. So keep an eye on guys who are at that 3 to 5 year mark in their first job or in their current job, because those guys who might have had middling success to this point might be incentivized to look elsewhere, because it essentially presses the reset button on their deal. Yeah. And we've seen a number of guys over the course of the last 5 to 6 years do that. And I think it's a fascinating phenomenon. It's one of the reasons, it's one of the things that goes into play for why, you know, a guy might make a choice that might otherwise not make perfect sense to somebody.
Yeah, a lot of lacrosse coaches are getting raises and job security.
Yeah.
Which is great.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, the fact that the schools it just shows that there's more emphasis and more eyeballs on the sport in the long run. All right, Terry, let's move on. Hopefully the next time we do this, we'll actually have something to report.
Yeah.
Because it's been an interesting few weeks, but it's besides the Galloway hiring and the Hartford promotion, really not a whole lot of concrete news.
Yeah, it's been hell on my phone bill.
So, Terry, have you been following sports? This is a...
Hey, you like sports, right?
Are you guys playing cards? So, you watching the Copa or the Euro?
Yeah. I mean, today is the day, right? So, I'm unfortunately going... not unfortunately. I'm about to get on a flight to Minnesota, and it's going to mean that I am unable to watch most of Game 5 of the NBA Finals and really take part in what was one of the world's great days for international football. It started at 9 a.m. on the East Coast, and it's going to run until 11 or 11:30, maybe even midnight, depending on how it develops between Copa and Euro Cup games.
I watched a lot of games yesterday. Germany. I think I started with Switzerland and Croatia. Yep. Maybe that was the day before or something. I don't know.
Yeah, they do start to bleed together. The best game I saw over the course of the week was, or at least the game that I enjoyed the most because I'm a Tottenham fan, is watching England play.
Yeah, you know, a lot with five Spurs. Of Spurs on there. A lot.
Really?
They're playing. There's some Arsenal guys on the team, but they're kind of...
not playing?
They're on the bench.
So it was unfortunate to see that end in a 1-1 draw, particularly given the fact that, you know, there had been violence preemptive and post that game in southern France. It's one of the sneaky great months for sports. Let me just real quick ask your opinion on the NBA Finals. Obviously, Draymond Green is suspended for Game 5. It goes back to the Oracle. Cavs were outclassed in Game 4. I will qualify this as saying that, yes, I'm a Cleveland native and a Cleveland Cavaliers fan. I came into this series with very low expectations, expected a four-game Warrior sweep in which they blew the Cavs out by 20 every game. So Game 3 is already giving me house money. That being said, this Draymond Green suspension turned what was, in my mind, 99 times out of 100 an elimination game into much more like a 50-50, 60-40 Shade Warriors type affair. What are your expectations going into Game 5?
I think the Cavs will win. I think Draymond does a lot for that team, and he's more than a glue guy. Like, that would be how you would describe his role. But he's point guard sometimes. You know, he guards whoever he wants on the court. They're going to miss him for sure. They have enough star power to win without him. But I think the NBA officiating crew, whoever is doing the game tonight, and the league office are going to sort of make sure that this series continues and goes back to Cleveland.
Well, we should move on because I don't think we have heard roundly that our listeners want to hear us stick to lacrosse, and we've got more to get to.
There's just as many listeners who email us and tell us to not talk about lacrosse, but just to talk about our own lives.
You're right, but
we're here to do a job. Yeah. So let's move on. So Terry,
we're going to apply our work in like attitude here.
You went down to the Tuartin Trophy Awards.
No, I didn't.
You went the day before.
I did.
You did. You were in D.C.
Yeah.
Dylan Malloy, odds-on favorite.
Yep.
Won the award. So, and then Taylor Cummings won the award on the women's side.
Yeah. So I went down on Wednesday night. They hosted a clinic at St. John's College High School in D.C. Under Armour has become increasingly more involved with the Tuartin Award, and St. John's is the alma mater of Under Armour founder Kevin Plank. It was a really cool event. Basically, they had a wide variety of boys and girls youth players, from all over the region, broken up into five or six stations. There were some legendary coaches there, including Cornell head coach Richie Moran, and all five finalists were helping out, showing kids the ropes. I wanted to go down there, have an opportunity to meet as many of the finalists that I had met before as I could, and got some time to spend with Dylan Malloy. He was not even on his scooter because he had gotten surgery. So this was Wednesday after Memorial Day. He had gotten surgery on Tuesday, and his only job at that point was to keep it as elevated as possible. And he had said he'd done a really nice job. So when I arrived, he was actually laying on the field with his foot up on his scooter, and then transitioned into the dugout of the adjacent baseball field. And the kids, after they finished with their station that he was kind of responsible for, ran over to the fence, and he addressed them through the fence, kind of giving them a few life lessons and stuff like that. It was really cool to see. It was the first time that I met Dylan and had an opportunity to talk to him casually and obviously asked him about his surgery. He said it, went pretty well, wasn't in a lot of pain. It was interesting to hear him talk about the experience in between the injury and when he came back onto the field, and how he really turned the corner the middle of the week leading up to the NCAA semifinals in terms of the pain starting to subside. Obviously, he was heavily wrapped and cushioned, and then was given a shot of lidocaine so that the pain was as diminished as possible when he made his way out onto the field for the semifinal matchup versus Maryland. It was crazy. One of the things that we spoke about was, I was like, well, what would have been interesting, or I guess what would have been less interesting to me, is if you had scored two goals, you know, both of which in transition, just kind of like time and room type shots. But no, I mean, your first goal was you dug your feet into the ground, put your shoulder into an All-American defenseman once, twice, three times, inside rolled and finished. And all that weight went onto that foot. Like, and I was just like, what did it feel like? What was the experience like? And, you know, he basically said, well, if I had done that later in the game, I don't think I would have been able to do it. At that point, it hurt, but it didn't really, like, register or impact my ability to actually finish the move. So I thought that was fascinating. And then, you know, kind of continuing on with the conversation, one of the things that really emerged, and, you know, it's hard to talk about this without putting into context the decision that Michael Quinn made in the first round game for Yale after he had torn his ACL, or depending on, you know, kind of who you speak to, maybe just aggravated and already at least partially torn ACL injury against Albany in late April. He came back and played on that after, I believe, 3 weeks of missing action in their first round tournament game against Navy. Ended up having to leave the game due to the injury. You know, it was pretty tough to watch in terms of being able to see visibly how much pain he was actually in. But, you know, Andy Shea, Michael Quinn, some of the Yale, you know, medical staff got some heat online for allowing, you know, the senior defenseman to play with that injury, you know, in terms of the personal safety, the long-term health, all that sort of stuff. And I know that there is a large-scale refrain, and we hear it frequently when we watch NFL games, you got to protect the players from themselves. That doesn't mean that it totally discounts their own free will, their own choice, particularly as it relates to non-head injuries where they're able to make these decisions for themselves. Because when you hear the conviction with which they speak about things, like in Dylan's case, I was on the sideline for the Navy game and I knew that I couldn't do that again. And it makes you understand a little bit more why you would make a choice to come back and play on a broken fifth metatarsal and, you know, deal with whatever you needed to deal with in the wake of that. You know, and similarly for a guy like Michael Quinn, who wasn't going to play college lacrosse again. He wasn't going to be able to get another year of eligibility based on the timing of his injury. You know, this was his last game, and you can understand, particularly in our sport, you know, somebody who values their college lacrosse experience so highly, you know, jeopardizing their future major league lacrosse experience or whatever else, saying, like, I'm going to have an ACL surgery anyway. It doesn't matter how injured my knee is. And I'm certainly not a physician. I'm not an orthopedist. I'm not in a position to say that that's, you know, a good or a bad choice. But I think that not often are people who are critical of the folks that make these types of decisions privy to the comments and the depth of the emotion in somebody who explains their decision of, I just want to be out there with my teammates, just want to be out there with my guys.
And that's really what it comes down to. Sometimes people say, oh, he selfishly wants to play because it's his last game. Well, it's for his teammates. It's for his school, his university, that he's, you know, he doesn't want to not be out there. And I think that's more about what it is. So Taylor Cummings won her third Dewaerten Trophy on the women's side. That's remarkable.
It is amazing. And I think that, you know, it's almost impossible to imagine somebody winning as a freshman just because it takes a certain amount of awareness prior to your arrival.
I mean, sometimes freshmen don't even get
Pat Spencer,
in the finalists.
Yeah, Pat Spencer was obviously very notably absent from the finalist list despite some strong opinions that was a mistake. And it was a function of the fact that people were unfamiliar with him. So this feels like a feat that will only ever be duplicated, if it is ever duplicated, and probably not surpassed. So from that end, Taylor Cummings is automatically in the conversation forever as, if not the best, one of the best women's lacrosse players of all time. I'm not familiar enough with women's lacrosse history to know whether she is indisputably the best women's lacrosse player of all time. My sense is that Jen Adams carries that mantle almost individually. It doesn't feel like there's a lot of argument against that. And so now we begin the conversation of who is better, Taylor or Jen Adams. You know, that's something that we'll leave to Hallie and the Iowa women's staff, who are far more equipped to handle that conversation. But, you know, certainly for a player who I think losing her final game is going to be a bitter pill to swallow. There's some consolation in the idea that even the best player in the history of the game can lose her last game.
Yeah. And poor Kayla Traynor. What an outstanding career she's had at Syracuse and sort of always come in second fiddle to Taylor Cummings.
Yeah, it reminds me a lot of Paul Rabil in that way. You know, finished, I believe, second. I guess we don't know for sure, but presumably second into Wharton voting to Matt Donowski in 2007 and then to Mike Lavelle in 2008. You know, just sometimes that's the way the cookie crumbles.
Yeah. Terry, the All-Americans came out. And there's a lot of them. Brown certainly rewarded some of their stars. Larkin Kemp, long stick midfielder. Dylan Malloy makes the first team attack.
Jack Kelly was the first team goalie. Will Garal was the first team faceoff specialist.
No, Trevor Baptiste was.
Oh, you're right. Will Garal was tied for the second team.
Speaking of four-time All-Americans, Trevor Baptiste is on pace to do that.
He certainly is that, yeah. Four-time first-team All-American. Yeah. But yes, to your point about volume, it was definitely the strongest reaction at the outset. So just some numbers. There were 16 first-teamers, 18 second-teamers, 22 third-teamers, and 37 honorable mention All-Americans. That adds up to 93. Traditionally, by my count, over the last 10 years, the number of total All-Americans awarded was between 92 and 100. So the overall volume isn't that out of the norm. And it actually might be a little bit on the low side.
There's always been a lot of honorable mention
guys. That's the thing. It's the balance between the teamers and the honorable mention guys. Teamers. I love that term.
I just think it's funny that, you know, there's one, Isaiah Davis Allen is the short stick midfielder on the first team. There's four short stick middies on the third team.
Yeah.
Four.
Yeah. Yeah, it's crazy. And there were, you know, five first team All-American midfielders. And so the question that has not been answered is this a function of ties or is this a function of choice? It's hard to believe that there are this many ties. And if there are, you need more voters to be able to create a point system that is a little bit more diverse so that the number of ties. And I also think that, like, the question then becomes, is the goal to have three attackmen, midfielders, and defensemen, and then one of each specialty position? And if that's the case, I'm actually okay with that. You know, it would create 13 All-Americans on each team, and it would mean you had, obviously, three attackmen, midfielders, and defensemen, one faceoff specialist, one short stick D-middie, one long stick D-middie, or one long stick middie, and one goalie. You know, and to me, even though there are 10 guys on the field, I am of the mind that there are actually 15 starters in a lacrosse game because there are two short stick D-middies. So I guess that would make 14. Excuse my math. You know, and that's just kind of the way that it goes. What's your opinion? Do you think that – would you rather see 30 teamers and then get on with it? Or what's –
Yeah. You know,
when so you do you think specialists should get
– I do because they play such a key role. And they're often deserving. I mean, I think the sport is specializing in a way that, you know, where would Trevor Baptiste fit in?
Would he have to take a spot from Miles Jones?
Yeah. So,
Teamer class or?
But I'd like to see more like 10 players plus a long stick and a face-off guy.
Okay. No short stick D-mitty?
Yeah, sure.
Okay. One per team?
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. I'm cool with that.
It makes it more. Look, I'm all for awarding people, and if you deserve it, but it takes away from some of the specialness when there's five midfielders on the first team,
yeah,
and you know, four on the second team and six on the third team. So that's when it used to just be there were nine attackmen who made first, second, and third team, and everybody else was an honorable mention person if they were honorably mentioned.
Yeah. Yeah, so when we do our face-off yearbook preseason All-America picks, we do four guys at each attack, midfield, and defense. And I honestly don't know why. Like, it was just kind of the way we did it when I arrived here, and we've kind of stuck with it ever since. I don't remember why we did, like, if there was ever even a reason. It doesn't really make very much sense. You know, we typically get chirped about it by, like, one Facebook commenter, you know, per year.
Same guy.
But, like, people had a much bigger problem, it seemed, with the volume of selections on this one than they did on Faceoff, than they do in our preseason rankings or preseason All-America teams.
Do you have any beef with any of the picks?
Yeah, I mean, see, when the positions on each team are so big, it's like kind of they create like a tier structure, and I don't necessarily have a problem with the tier structure. It would be like the delineation there within. So my argument is that like Sergio Perkovic and Dylan Donahue did not have first-team All-American seasons.
Agreed.
So both of those guys should drop to the second team, which then means that you have three first-team All-Americans on the first team at attack and four midfielders. So it's not as if I think that, you know, even though you could make an argument, I would listen to an argument that Pat Spencer was a first-team All-American, but you have to choose between Dylan Malloy, Connor Canizero, and Ben Reeves, who he deserves it over. If that were the choice, I'd probably say that he deserves it over Ben Reeves, and then Ben Reeves would fall to the second-team All-American. I think that's really splitting hairs. I think there was a lot about Spencer's season and Ben Reeves' season that were very similar. I think that I would actually argue that between Hairwires and the three first-line midfielders, Spencer had a little bit more to work with offensively, but that's offset by the function of he's a freshman and Reeves is a sophomore. But then you have to ask yourself, well, do you get an extra point for being a freshman? Like, is that something that, you know, or should we all be held to the same standard of performance regardless of experience? So, again, you know, that's a pretty – to me, that's like a pretty minor distinction between those two. But then if you do that, you end up with five attackmen on the second team, five midfielders on the second team. So then it's a question of like, all right, well, now do you feel like you have to bump two of them down in order to make this justifiable? So in that way, like, you know, it's possible that Sergio Perkovic didn't even have a second team All-American season. But then you think back to some of the individual moments, particularly the Virginia overtime, and some of the things that helped propel Notre Dame to the season that they had leading up to, you know, a disappointing last couple of games. And it's like, even though his production wasn't as high as, you know, some of the guys that you would consider him next to, you know, some of the individual moments and individual performances helped to differentiate him in a positive way. And that's where you feel a little bit more comfortable, you know, kind of having him settle in where he was. You know, and similarly with Donahue to a degree, you know, I think for him, the story of the season was that he was better at the beginning of the season than he was toward the end. And that's not even, that's a little bit misleading. I actually ran those numbers in mid-April, and his production had basically stayed the same. You know, it was more so, I think, a function of, you know, kind of his team's performances, who they ran up against, that sort of thing. To be perfectly honest, yeah, I wasn't able to watch the Maryland-Syracuse game very closely in the quarterfinals. So, you know, I think that there was a sense among some folks that, you know, he was left off with a worse taste in their mouth than he was with me.
What were some of the selections that you thought the coaches got right?
Well, one that I thought I didn't expect, and honestly, I probably would have criticized it on Saturday morning, but by the end of the day on Monday, I was like, no, that's the right call, was Jake Mattei as a second-team short stick D-Mitty. I think that Isaiah Davis Allen had really separated himself from the rest of that group over the course of the season. I think that Jack Adams had been a guy, particularly after the Denver game, that received a lot of the credit for Towson's success defensively because, you know, I think when you looked at Towson's defense, it was like, Tyler White is obviously awesome. He's very consistent. But each of those three long close defensemen are pretty similar. Like, yeah, you know, maybe there's some hierarchy in the way that they delineate their matchups, but I like all three of them. You know, Lowe probably stands out the most. I think he was the highest awarded, but I like Cordes as well. You know, I liked what each of them did individually. So maybe it's like Adams' divergence from the norm within that group that impressed the most. But then really, like, when you look at Carolina, and I don't know if this is necessarily why the coaches voted to have Mattei as a second-team All-American, not only was his performance really exceptional and what he brought to the team really exceptional, but I think he really stopped, you know, over that final four, the semifinal and the final, you got a sense of how close to the emotional core he was to that team, how much of a leader he was for that team. And I think that when you can include that, and it's very difficult to do. It's also impossible to do consistently because it's something that, you know, you really need to experience and see in order to be able to apply correctly. you know, when you, but in this case, because we were all fortunate enough to see that on that big stage, I think that, you know, it justifies that decision pretty significantly. What about for you? Was there anybody, you know, to your eye who either you felt like was too high or snubbed, or was there anybody that you felt like was a surprisingly accurate pick?
I feel like they do a pretty good job on this. I mean, all these guys are deserving. They had great seasons. It's funny to watch, you know, you're looking at it and you see a lot of Denver, a lot of Brown, some Maryland, but there's not a lot of UNC guys on here. If you could sort of do this after the Final Four, pretty sure Chris Cloutier would have been at least honorable mention after his performance that weekend, and he's nowhere on this list at all. Austin Fafani was the only other UNC player, defenseman, to make the third team of the teamers, we'll call it that. But no, it's always funny to see the names written out, you know, formally. Shackelford Stanwix, always fun to see it like that. But it's, you know, it's just a nice way to wrap up the season, I guess.
Yeah, well, and I think that, you know, the USILA traditionally had announced these over the course of the week leading up to the Final Four, starting on Monday or Tuesday, and then, you know, successively leading up to Saturday. And this year chose, both in terms of the All-Americans, the individual player awards, D2, D3, to save everything for the weekend. And I don't know. It would be interesting to run a little bit of a analysis on that and say, you know, in comparison to previous years, how aware are people of what the selections were? Because I think there's an argument to be made that when you, you know, drop this at 8:30 on the morning of the semifinals, everybody's going to look at it, but everybody's going to look at it and then move on to their next thing. Yeah. They're not necessarily going to digest and absorb it the way that they would, you know, if you had done this on Thursday morning. And maybe that's a good or a bad thing. I don't know.
Yeah, so the position awards came out, Terry. I love that the Outstanding Goalie Award is a thing. It's always just the first-team All-American goalie, Jack Kelly of Brown. Outstanding Attackman, the Turnbull Award, went to Dylan Malloy. Not a lot of surprises there. Outstanding Defensive Player, the Schmeisser Award, went to Matt Landis from Notre Dame. And the Outstanding Midfield was Miles Jones from Duke, which is the Donald McLaughlin Jr. Award. And then they have an award for the most outstanding player, sort of like the standout of standouts. That's the Enners Award, and that also went to Dylan Malloy.
Yeah, so
Dylan Malloy cleans up in event season.
Yeah.
In award season, I should say.
Yeah, it's interesting because there are some years where the Enners traditionally goes to an attackman. And there are some years in which they split up the Attackman of the Year and the Player of the Year. And then others where it goes to the same guy. Just kind of an interesting observation. But, yeah, I mean, the Enners Award is, you know, really it's funny. Both Player of the Year awards have their flaws in terms of their selection processes. The Enners Award certainly has tradition. The Tewarden Award has the attention. That's kind of the value of each in the way that they kind of separate itself. But the Tewarden Award, because it limits itself to a 5-player pool before the tournament begins, but then you select of those 5 players after the tournament is over, essentially it's an award of the best 5 players from the regular season who then had the best performance in the playoffs. So there's value in that, but it's a lot different from the Heisman in terms of the way that that's constructed, because the Heisman Trophy is selected before the bowls. It'd be really interesting to see, good to a, you know, kind of a you know, historical revision of, if we selected the Heisman Trophy after the bowls, who, like, how many years would the same guy have won?
Vinny Testaverde would not have won the Heisman.
Troy Smith would not have won the Heisman.
No. Yeah.
So, and then the question becomes, who would have? Which is also an interesting question. You know, whereas the Enners Award is selected, I believe, after the quarterfinals. And takes into account the first 2 weeks of the playoffs. Hmm. So, but it's all encompassing. It doesn't have any restrictions or limitations. So presumably would be a little bit more free and flexible, you know, to pick a guy like Pat Spencer at that point.
Yeah. So Pat Spencer was one of two freshmen to make the All-American team. Colin Burke was the other one.
Just want to say bravo on that transition, particularly given the fact that you had to switch pages to the next page in the rundown.
Oh, thanks. Good like that. And Jack Rowlett, you thought he deserved.
Yeah. So you mentioned the lack of Carolina players on the All-America team. I thought Jack Rowlett was, I don't want to say he was their best defenseman. You mentioned that Austin Pafani was a third-team All-American, a junior captain, has been a consistent starter since his freshman year. So certainly, you know, tremendous amount of credit deserved. But Jack Rowlett was awesome and statistically was their best performer.
He led the defensemen in ground balls.
And caused turnovers, yeah. You know, so I just thought that of the two guys that earned All-America honors, and certainly Colin Burke, the way that he finished his season was remarkable. You know, and certainly I think Fairfield can feel confident in his hands going forward. I didn't think that there was enough separation, and particularly when you look at the All-America list and realize how few honorable mention defensemen, and there was only one honorable mention goalie, there are and were. You know, it feels like maybe finding a spot for Rowlett would have been appropriate. And while we're talking about freshmen and freshman rankings, so it's something that I've been doing, I believe, since 2008. If you click on any of the freshman rankings posts, you'll be able to go back to 2010 to find that information. It's a tough and daunting process. I mean, you know, there's probably a better way to go about doing it than I do, but basically it's just, you know, in the three iterations at which I do it, I analyze the, you know, all the statistical categories, pull out all the freshmen, then go through all of the conference player of the week and player of the year awards at the end of the season, you know, and then kind of cascade down from there and build it out. By the end of the year, I had probably about 140 names to parse through and update before whittling it down to 25 and then trying to rank from there. There were two guys who, you know, and typically defensemen and long sticks don't get – close defensemen are the ones that are the hardest to include in this conversation. This was an exceptional year for freshman close defensemen as well. And two guys that got left off the 25 that, you know, were probably candidly mistakes on my end. Long stick Mitty from Lehigh, Craig Chick, and Air Force defenseman Brandon Jones. So just something to keep in mind as you take a look at that list moving forward. One of those things I wish I could have a slight mulligan on.
And you ranked 25 guys, and it's Spencer is your number one.
Spencer was one, Burke was two, and Rowlett was three, yeah.
Also, Terry, Christian Sweezy.
The year ahead.
Yeah, already looking at his way ahead, 2017 rankings. A fun read. I love reading Christian's stuff, and he really takes a good look at this. He's his number 20 team, the UMBC Retrievers.
Yeah,
UMBC Retrievers.
It's a stunning choice, and I think that it's a reflection of why it's so much fun to read Christian's stuff, because he's so well-informed, but he does have a very unique perspective. He doesn't ascribe to the conventional wisdom, and when you ask him to write about something, you always get an angle that you didn't expect, or almost always. And when you ask him his opinion on a certain set of teams, players, whatever, you know, I frequently don't agree with him. And, you know, that's one of the reasons why having him do the way ahead rankings makes so much sense. Because if any of us that works in the office full time did it, it'd probably be pretty boring. So, yeah, I mean, it started, you open it up, and there's UMBC, a team that went 4-10 last year and doesn't have a coach staring you right in the face. That being said, I saw their last game of the season. They came back from, I believe, 8 goals down against Albany to take the game to overtime. And you could tell that there was a fire there. You know, it was it's a team that over the last 3 years I've just questioned their talent, and particularly in contrast to what their talent level was in the Brendan Mundorf, Drew Westervelt, Pete Poyon, Kyle Weimer days, Alex Hopman, Terry Kemener, you know, some great, great players. You know, I think that in retrospect, Nate Lunas was an incredible goal scorer. He led the nation in goals by, I believe, 0.6 of a goal on a per game average, which is a remarkable margin. But he's gone. And so now, you know, there are a few guys, Max Maxwell leading the way, who are familiar faces, but there's a lot of questions surrounding the program as well, not the least of which is who's going to be the leader of it going forward. So, you know, to say that they're going to be better than 50 teams in Division One in a year in which we saw some teams that were ranked in the top 20 in faceoff yearbook, like Georgetown, like Colgate, fall outside of the top 40. You know, it's a daunting choice. It's a question, not questionable. we're questioning it, but that's not what I mean. It's just a bold choice.
So counting back from 10, he's got Yale comes in at 10, Duke at number 9, Navy number 8, Brown State number 7, my Hopkins Blue Jays coming in at 6. And
Loyola Greyhounds at number 5.
Yeah, sneaking in at number 5.
North Carolina Tar Heels at number 4.
Mm-hmm. Maryland, number 3. Denver, number 2.
And Notre Dame, number 1.
Sweezy's number 1 team entering next year.
Yeah, so it's funny because the explanation for choosing Notre Dame number 1 sounds like a defense. It's like, how do you graduate Lannis and Kavanaugh?
Yeah.
And keep them number 1. You know, when so much of the argument behind why they were number 1 heading into this season had to do with they had arguably the best player at every position at attack, midfield, and goalie with
Shane Doss.
At defenseman. Yeah, well, it emerged that way through the early part of the season, but I skipped over Perkovic there at the midfield. Doss and Perkovic both coming back. You know, there are a few additions, both in terms of I think that they're going to get a grad transfer or two that will, make some waves. And then I think that, they've got some really top-end talent coming in. The strength of this Notre Dame team going forward is going to be what it had been for probably all of that span of time from 2011 to 2015. Incredible depth of two-way midfielders, guys who can play defense, probably will primarily play defense, but bring the ball into the box and be dangerous. And I think we saw that, toward the end of last season after Nick Koshansky's injury, the emergence of guys like Timmy Phillips and Austin Gase. I think that one of the kind of not as well paid attention to freshman who I thought was excellent over the course of the season was Drew Shantz. Bringing in Brian Costabile, a guy that we're familiar with as his coach.
He's outstanding.
Is in our office every day, a U.S. U19 player, and he's not the only one. And then, a couple of the long sticks that they're bringing in are going to be similarly athletic as well. So they're going to be able to push the ball really, really well. And then they've got the foundational pieces at attack. They've got a sophomore in Ryder Garnsey who's shown the ability to control the offense, I think. And then a more dynamic than has received credit for junior in Mikey Wynn. So obviously they need to figure out who that third attackman is. And then in addition to replacing the Schmeisser winner, I believe they also have to replace Evan Glazner. So there will be two new starters down low. But Garrett Eppel is really close to a Schmeisser Award winner himself. And if he can stay healthy, will definitely be a solid backline solution. And then, beyond him, I'm sure that there are 6 guys who are ready to pick up the mantle as the next in the legacy of Notre Dame Coles. So, I think that the pieces are there. It's the question of ranking. How do you feel like they stack up to the other teams that deserve claim toward that number one spot?
Interesting fact that Sweezy has in his article, the Fighting Irish have lost to the eventual national champion in 9 of the past 11 years, including 5 straight.
Yeah. Yeah, and I don't know what that means. Does it mean that they...
It just seems...
Does it mean that beating Notre Dame is a launching pad for winning the national championship?
Not necessarily. I think it's just a coincidence.
Okay.
In some regard.
It does mean in Notre Dame's case that they... they were as close as you could have been, arguably. But that's, obviously when you lose in the national championship game a couple times, that's right. Goes without saying.
But, yeah, interesting fact there. And, Terry, I think we're about to wrap this up.
Yeah. Well, so, Dan, it's been a really good season.
I really enjoyed doing this.
I'm still in the search for new words to live by. We're not done, by the way.
No?
No.
Oh, the podcast.
Yeah, we got some stuff to talk about.
Yeah, sure.
But
give the people what they want, Terry.
Why don't we make those the new words to live by?
Give the people what they want. Yeah. Love it. All right, everybody. Have a good week.
Stole your line. Inside Lacrosse Podcast.